Letter to Malcolm Edwards, January 29, 1975, 4:135. Dear Malcolm, one thing I've meant to write to you about, did I? Is the long piece you wrote on Flow My Tears, which will appear in England's Soul SF magazine. Malcolm, at the risk of repeating myself in case I said this already, in that piece, you expressed certain ideas about my writing which struck me as so important and so meaningful that I was dazzled, and for me, anyhow, it was one of those rare critical works which shed a fundamentally new light on my own work for me, the author. It made sense out of things in my work, aspects, underlying connectives, which I had never discerned properly, but had tried to discern. In particular, your remarks about Ubik jolted my mind into furious and delighted activity. I've sent the piece on to a lady who is writing a postgraduate thesis on my writing, telling her how important, how truly astonishing your piece is, in my opinion. When you discuss how the idioscosmos is invaded by what I think you describe as the strangely different koinos cosmos, this makes sense out of a lot of what I perpetually write about. Also, when you discuss how the various idioscosmoses, whatever the plural is, how a bunch of them may still be only a proliferation, a kind of mutual agreement to extend one idioscosmos, one partial view from person to person, which is still not a genuine koinos cosmos. Malcolm, you have come up with a totally new concept, in my opinion. To phrase it baldly, there can be shared idioscosmoses, giving the impression of illusion of a koinos cosmos. The latter have the aspect of authenticity, the former not, however many people share it. What comes to my mind in this regard would be when a tyrannical state so manages the news and so manipulates the ideas and thoughts of its citizens, shutting out facts from their purview entirely, that together they collectively share a sort of ersatz koinos cosmos, which is nothing more than the approved idios cosmos manufactured synthetically by the state. It could fail to incorporate into it certain vital elements, without which, however, many people share it and ratify it. It still fails to partake of reality, in the sense that an authentic koinos cosmos should. Multiple incorrectness, however frequently ratified, does not create accuracy, does it not? A deliberate structure artifact, which they jointly maintain against the threat of reality, against what, if they somehow relaxed, they would find they could allow to seep in, as it later does. They have collectively generated their reality outside their field of conscious awareness. At night in sleep, this mental mechanism dims and other elements slide in, but are, of course, ruled out the next day on awakening as being mere phantasms. After the bomb blast in Ubik, as I was writing it, I suddenly had to stop to realize with a jolt, I recall that day well as I sat at my typewriter empty-headed and empty-paged, as it were, with no preconception at all as to how their new world would be compared with the one they'd been living in. They were alive. They had been killed all at once for plot purposes. I needed to imagine a world, so to speak, as it was, which the closest analog we commonly discuss would be. What is the room like when I'm not in it? I tried to imagine their world for them when it lacked this projection machinery and artifact-like material which they naturally, as we do, maintained constantly outside awareness. Being dead, they had no force. No force, no motion has now. She neither sees nor hears, or however it goes. Guess it's hears and sees to go with trees. I sat at my typewriter for a boundless eternity, imagining their world stripped away, and without realizing it, I was imagining their true koinos cosmos seeping in. What is more thought-provoking is this. What is true of one universe, theirs, would be true of all universes, which would include ours. Thus, the bare-bones koinos cosmos after the bomb blast in Ubik would presumably be ours as well, our authentic koinos cosmos, if we somehow pierced the veils, or rather, if the veils drifted away from between us and it, as we relaxed for whatever reason our constant projections which we mutually share. At the time I wrote Ubik, it never occurred to me that the world depicted in the latter part of Ubik might in some fundamental way give or take a bit here and there, be our own. Could we see it properly? I wrote the book and forgot how I came to write it. That in point of fact, I created a sort of a priori paradigm of what a universe would have to have, minimum to exist, without reference to what I saw daily in my own. Ubik, the world, was arrived at a priori. But now I discern in Ubik certain traditional elements. I discern them only by studying night and day my various reference works. 1. The Logos, i.e., Runciter talking and writing notes to them. 2. The twin competing interacting subforces, which Empedocles described, Ella versus Jory, which is love versus hate, a kind of dialectic interaction generating all change. 3. Ubik as an omnipresent energy field, which would be the ancient notion of God as immanent mind infusing the universe within it rather than above it, or in Hindu terms, the Atman, the breath of God. 4. The manner of regression of forms, which takes place, runs along an axis which is, so to speak, at right angles to the form-progressing axis we usually envision, but it is logically there, although not within our range of immediate perception. However, Plato's Eidola weren't within immediate perception either, and still aren't. Given the other elements of the Ubik world as being theoretically possible as underpinnings of our own, but not disclosed or available to us in a perceptual sense, then this too may be a valid view as to 1. The actual existence of the Platonic archetypes, the ideal forms, and 2. How they progress or decay, as incising takes place or for some reason fails to take place. It all constitutes together a harmonious Greek worldview, consistent with itself and available, as I say, a priori. Even the small point of negative ionization as a factor in Ubik the force is consistent with Reich's view of the organ force he posits, which was linked to ionization, especially in the atmosphere. I just learned that amongst all the rest. Note: Wilhelm Reich, 1897 to 1957, was a controversial German psychologist, a student of Freud, and the originator of the notion of organ energy. End note. Organ, as an underlying semi-living life energy, cosmic in origin, the link between the living and the non-living, would be roughly equal to Ubik, although not conceived by Reich as a sentient. I obviously conceive of Ubik as sentient, perhaps a bioplasmic life form related to the Logos, as the three members of the Christian Trinity are related to each other and one another. Runciter as Christ Ubik, as immanent God Runciter, when not visible, but writing to them as Logos, which I see now, by my logic, makes Logos and Christ the same, which was St. John's view anyhow in his Gospel. Imagine having arrived at St. John's view of Christ a priori. Should I notify the Pope? What ties all this up, for me anyhow, is about 10 months ago, I began reading about two fascinating new areas of study. Robert Ornstein's work in causing the right hemisphere to come on in people. His view, as I'm sure you know, being that we only use our left, and also the orthomolecular vitamin formula, which is supposed to produce radically improved neural firing in the brain. As if there weren't enough, I also began to read what to me was the most extraordinary idea of all, that the human brain, are you ready, can transduce external electrical fields, both high and low frequency, if the fields are weak, if the thermal factor is low, and if it so does, its efficiency is augmented by the field influx. Well, Malcolm, having the orthomolecular vitamin formula in my possession, I began experimenting, and to compound all this, I had written the rough draft of my new novel, A Scanner Darkly, in which I studied the drug-damaged brain and concluded that the basic impairment, which I'd seen in the burnt-out members of the drug subculture which so horrified me, had to do with split-brain phenomena of some obscure kind, and had done a vast amount of study on this and theorizing for the novel. Putting all the above together, I set out to obtain a radically improved efficiency in my own neural firing, with the emphasis on, hopefully, causing my unused right hemisphere to wink on and function as Ornstein at Stanford says it ought to. "We sent half a man to the moon," is Ornstein's phrase. In mid-March, I got abrupt, dazzling results, which I'd prefer not to go into just yet. Recently, when the New Yorker interviewer came to interview me, he had a friend with him, and it turned out they know Ornstein personally and are well acquainted with his research and theories. This gave me a long-sought-for chance to discuss my 10-month experiences to someone who could tell me, did I indeed cause my right hemisphere to come on? And are my experiences genuine? Yes, indeed, they decided after listening to me. We talked all afternoon, the interview forgotten, so important did we mutually consider this stuff to be. Basically, Malcolm, when I had both brain hemispheres functioning in tandem, in a parity relationship, each involved both in perception and cognition, I saw around me a different universe. It was briefly, I later realized, it took me 3 months to so identify it, the universe I had depicted in Ubik. Most thrilling of all, I did indeed transduce an external, very weak energy field. I think, as with most science, simply knowing it can be done is half the job, which gradually drained off during the following weeks. This explained the astonishingly great jump in neural efficiency which I experienced. It also disastrously upset the physical equilibrium of my body. It raised my blood pressure from 140 over 93 to 268 over 170, causing my doctor to hospitalize me instantly, which shows the risk in these matters. It isn't only the brain which took the ergic influx, evidently, but my whole neurological system. However, the field did drain off normally and gradually. But during the time it was incorporated within me, I got a priceless chance to experience for the first time the true koinos cosmos. The true things in themselves, which Kant felt we could never experience. A vast noetic factor lived in me. I both saw and comprehended in a single mentational act, although it's taken me months to label what I encountered, e.g., the Logos, God as immanent mind within the structural framework of reality surrounding me. I think what was the most thrilling of all, above and beyond everything else, which was new to me, was visually to observe the constant, steady, unfailing signaling systems by which all living organisms are disinhibited, which is to say, their engrammed and then blocked instinctive patterns imprinted on them at the beginning are periodically released at the correct moment for the appropriate occasion. In this fashion, chaos becomes cosmos and harmony and stability, and regulated interaction between all parts of the structure are perpetually achieved. Being outside the ontological categories at one point, I could watch signals coming up, about to be disclosed. We humans receive them as well as the animals do, but don't realize it, since the signals, when they are disclosed to us, can't be resisted. At the same time, the interior engrammed assembly fires, giving us the delusional sense of internal volition. We wish to do what we then do. Thus I watched, fascinated, to see that we are never out of the hands of our Creator, the immanent God which surrounds us. The concept of entelechy of Aristotle, that our patterns are entirely within us and unfold during our life, is a sublime delusion. We have part within, but part is outside because otherwise disjunction with our environment would occur almost at once. New views as to the nature of schizophrenia, in which the person withdraws and hence fails to receive or tries to fail to receive these essential disinhibiting external signals, may someday arise. His manifold internal programmed systems installed in him at conception can't properly fire since regular, orderly disinhibition is impeded by his fugue. Like Jonah, he flees God. He flees his destiny, which is to say, his instructions as to how to grow and become. Well, Malcolm, I've said more than I intended. Much of this would have gone into my London speech. Some had, in the part I've done before flu hit. Before closing, I want to stress that I was indeed lucky, although my heightened view of the world showed me that what we call luck is arranged methodically by our guiding Creator and doesn't happen by chance, inasmuch as not only did I transduce an external field successfully into the electrical field of my neurological system, as has been shown in laboratory work over recent years, but that field which I transduced was, shall we say, a benign one. That is, it promoted both mental and physical healing in me. A long process, but a start, inasmuch as I am quite a bit better off in both counts than before. I would characterize this transduced field as a semi-living bioplasmic field, sentient and deathless. I could see it in a few subtle arrangements outside me, so I realized that it had been present but not visible to me. I don't know about weak fields. I lack the technical training to identify it. But it is a plasma, very heavy, and although possessing enormous mass, capable of terrific velocity on occasion. Like red and gold shining mercury, it flowed off and disappeared almost as soon as I spied it, which was only a couple of times. When it pours into a person, which it can do and does do on rare occasions, he claims that the Holy Spirit entered him, or Dionysus, if that's the name by which he calls his god, or Apollo. I personally like to think of it as Mr. Runciter, still working ceaselessly to assist his friends, to give them the advice and help of a much older, wiser person. Let me know what you think of all this, Malcolm. And again, thank you for your article on tears. Cordially, Phil Dick. Letter to Malcolm Edwards, January 31st, 1975. 4-147. Dear Malcolm, would you object if I completed my presentation to you of the material contained in my last two letters, January 29th and January 30th? I just want to add a point or so. What I saw about the external disinhibiting structure, which evidently surrounds each human being as a sort of cube-like chamber, was the utilization of every sort of datum, especially visual, so that when required, that particular datum projected a signal, as I mentioned, which the intended person to be disinhibited received. Other persons would not respond, since they would not be engrammed to respond to that signal. They would, in fact, perceive no signal at all. The intended individual would experience a sudden transformation of the ground set formation of the environment around him. One item would come forward, alter from ground, and become set, then go back once more to resume its passive or inert mode, its park, its waiting mode. This appeared to me much like an enormous number of corrective rocket jets, very small, such as would be mounted on an interplanetary vehicle. They could fire at any time, in any sequence, producing the most precise change in the course of the vehicle itself, stabilizing it, causing it to pick up or lose velocity. You can see the analogy. What in regard to us seemed to me especially high in this utility was written material of any and all sorts, any sign, any ad, any piece of paper, the resemblance to Runciter's communicating with the people via the trash of the gutter, the debris, such as match folders, the labels of spray cans, etc. This is exactly what I actually saw myself as functioning in the highest fashion to guide and instruct us, these same verbal instruments. It is evident why, eventually, I would suppose the presence of the Logos. Also, I saw a continual use of the joining of two verbal items. They would be kept separate, and hence not causing disinhibiting to occur until the proper moment. I saw various written items rotate, so to speak, very slowly, inexorably, like a solenoid clock as it ticks along. Then, two separate verbal items, such as an ad for beer plus a street sign with the word Crescent Drive on it, to make up an example. These might remain separate and not be gestalted into one unit by the person for an indefinite time, would by inexorable degrees come together and mesh into an entity. At once they would signal and cause neural firing of an inhibited engrammed system in the person. He would not know why he suddenly did what he did. He would feel volition, like a person under a post-hypnotic suggestion, invent in his mind a plausible explanation. That all this would form an enormous and complex world clock, synchronized with itself, is evident. Where free will enters, I saw, is that between the flashing of disinhibiting signals to a person, he is free to play, to do what he wishes, like a child at recess between classes. He can do whatever he wants, until he hears the bell sounding. And, as I perceived it, once the bell sounds, which is to say, the disinhibiting signal, he must do what is required, since the total person, the autonomic nervous system, is engaged. I did not reason this out. I saw this. I also saw the Logos as it reached from our future into our present, which is the only world we have, our present, to make use of the arrangements of things. It had no power, no force or strength to compel what was, but it could somehow arrange what the original efficient causes at the start of time had brought into being. The forward-moving force of time, enormously powerful as it was, seemed oblivious of the subtle arranging by the spirit or logos. It always seemed taken by surprise by the resulting combinations arranged. They seemed to thwart its rather blind purposes. Also, I came to understand this. With all creatures other than man, instinct is the same for each individual of the species. All dragonflies are programmed alike. But, I saw, each individual human being is programmed uniquely in terms of 1. The signals he can and will encounter during his life, and 2. According to the unique and special purpose set for him by his Creator. A specific destiny is thereby arranged for each person. When he is born, his destiny is in him, and all that is needed is to set him in motion. His Creator knows from the start everything which that person will encounter, and his Creator has, by this engramming and signaling system, made it possible to determine and control in advance how the person will go along his course. It is not random. It is not accidental. It never lacks purpose, although I saw sometimes, for extended time periods, the person, any given person, must of necessity be placed on hold. He must mark time until the rest of the cosmos is ready, since everything has to be coordinated.